Welcome to the Center for Financial Inclusion's podcast series. In this episode, Axion International's Monica Brand speaks with Craig Churchill of the International Labor Association on his work in microinsurance.
I'm Monica Brand, Principal Director for Axion International. I manage a fund called Frontier Investments that's trying to pursue innovation in financial inclusion. I'm here today at the Center for Financial Inclusion to speak with Craig Churchill on his work in microinsurance. Craig heads up the Microinsurance Innovation Facility at the International Labor Organization. Thanks, Craig, for being here. And let's just move right into some questions. I think it's good to help frame the discussion for our listeners and understand a little bit about how ILO defines microinsurance and why it's of interest to them.
The ILO comes at microinsurance from two different perspectives. One is from a social protection perspective, saying that lots of people in the informal economy don't have access to the types of social protection services that people who work in the formal sector have. And so is there a way in which it's possible to extend social protection services to workers in the informal economy in a way that can reach to them? The other perspective that we have on microinsurance is from a financial systems perspective. And there, the idea is that the ILO is interested in promoting social justice within the financial system. Low-income people, people working in the informal economy, don't have access to the same services that other workers do. So the idea with microinsurance is to provide insurance to workers in the informal economy, either from a social protection perspective or from a financial services perspective.
You know, that's interesting. Frontier Investments, in the fund I manage, it's similar. We look at the microinsurance from dual perspectives, one from a social value and how do you provide services to the base of the pyramid that's not there. We also look at it from a business model, meaning how do you show that this kind of service can actually be financially sustainable. How much do you use the ILO, do you think about the business model perspective, and what products or businesses are of particular interest to you in terms of what you're looking at?
So the idea of sustainability could come in two different ways. One is that it's sustainable because the premiums that are paid cover all the costs of operating that service. Mm-hmm. So that would be the business perspective. And then the other idea of sustainability is that there's a long-term or semi-permanent source of subsidy that enables that service to be there for the long term. And those would be two ends of a spectrum. And I think what you find is that from a social protection perspective, many governments in developing countries just don't have the resources to provide these types of social protection services to their citizens, particularly those in greatest need of those services. So to make the possible for those services to be available, it's useful to think through somewhere in between. So it may be not a purely public or purely private perspective, but some sort of public-private partnerships.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting, especially maybe if we look at where the industry is today. And I don't know if you would agree with this. There are a lot of people who talk about the need for good risk mitigation or risk management for the poor. And need we're finding, well, that need is definitely verified in our market research, but we're finding there's a difference between need and demand. And what we found, and I wonder how much this reflects yours, is that there's not maybe a culture of insurance. The way people think about insurance might either be that they don't understand it or they might have a negative view of sort of insurance companies taking advantage of them. How do you think about the market for microinsurance? And what do you think of some of the efforts that are being done either through consumer education or some of those public activities that might create more of an insurance culture so that there is a bigger market ultimately?
A lot of the market research that has been done related to risks shows that people definitely don't trust insurance companies, or they don't know what insurance is or how it works, which is quite ironic because a lot of the insurance that exists today, 200 years ago when insurance companies started, it was insurance for the poor. It was poor getting together and finding ways of creating some sort of social protection systems for themselves through mutuals and cooperatives. And a lot of the insurance products that existed, collecting penny premiums at the factory gates were really targeted at the poor. And over the years, I guess at that point, the rich could self-insure, so they didn't bother wasting their money on premiums. If they experienced a risk, they would just be able to cover it themselves. But over the years, insurance has evolved to be just the opposite. It's much more focused at the upper end of the market, big businesses, wealthy individuals. And what we're trying to do at the ILO's Microinsurance Innovation Facility is to really encourage insurance to get back to its roots, mm-hmm. and get back to basics, and find ways of making itself relevant again for low-income people. I mean, the one way that insurers can start overcoming that is by partnering with organizations that have the trust of the low-income market, and working with delivery channels, because insurers aren't particularly good at reaching the poor directly. Working with delivery channels that the poor informal workers do trust, mm-hmm. and then helping to overcome some of the reticence through that delivery channel. Mm-hmm. And then the other way is by paying claims. too often insurers are known for being very slow and reluctant to pay claims. And what we're trying to say is, come on, that's your best way of getting to this market and showing them that you're serious, is by fulfilling your obligations as quickly as possible and not taking a typical insurance approach of trying to find ways of not paying claims.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that's something that distinguishes microinsurance, really trying to make it relevant from the point of view of the base of the pyramid. Another question I have on relevance, it's interesting you mentioned about bringing insurance back to its roots. One of the things that we hear a lot is that to the extent that microinsurance has made inroads, the products that are most commonly offered in microinsurance, usually credit life or some kind of life insurance, aren't necessarily the products that are most in demand. I'm wondering, do you agree with that? And can you share maybe some interesting things that you've seen that are trying to close this supply gap?
So back to this market research across countries, what you find is great variety of the risks that people are vulnerable to and the ones that they have difficulty coping with through their own mechanisms. So one takeaway from that is that you can't just sort of take a set of products and roll them out everywhere. You have to think through the local circumstances and make sure that you're providing products that are appropriate for that audience. At the same time, you find two risks that pop up in almost any study, and that's related to illness and death. And so there is a huge priority areas for those two topics or two risks to be addressed through microinsurance. And life insurance, addressing death risks is by far the most common type of insurance that is available because it's the easiest. Somebody's dead, it's irrefutable, and it only happens once. And the risk is very low in most cases of that happening in the next period of time. So it's quite easy from an insurance perspective to insure death. The one that's really hard is health, which is what so many people want. And to try to address that need, what you find some innovations that are quite interesting coming up. One is saying, okay, we can't provide Cadillac service to everybody. We have to develop products that the poor can afford. And so we want to find a way that enables them to pick the health risks that they're most concerned about and being able to cover those rather than trying to cover everything. So there's a bit of a rationing process involved, but at least if you're involving them in the process of selecting what illnesses are covered, that gives them some control over the product. Often inpatient hospitalization is what's primarily covered, and outpatient is not covered, is the typical situation. And the logic behind that is a real insurance logic that, for small expenses, people can pay for things out of their products, but what they can't afford is the big ticket, the more expensive costs often associated with hospitalization.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So maybe just explain inpatient versus outpatient. Do you want to just explain the difference?
So outpatient would be going to the doctor, getting a consultation, getting a prescription. Actually, pharmaceuticals tends to be this major issue in microinsurance because the cost associated with the medicines tends to be much more than the actual care itself. Mm-hmm. And so where insurance can include pharmaceuticals, that's in great demand by the poor. And one of the things that we need to find in order to make microinsurance more affordable is to find ways of getting pharmaceutical companies involved in lowering the prices, because it's a huge challenge to be able to provide that type of service at a premium that the poor can afford.
Are any of the grantees that I know that you fund through your facility, are they making inroads in any of these areas, either on the illness or on the death side, or any interesting models that you think might be fun to share?
On the health side is, the biggest challenge. I mean, one organization that we're working with in Uganda is making some interesting efforts to try to control pharmaceutical costs. One of the challenges they have is they are working with healthcare providers, and so the other constraint that they're experiencing is fraud from the healthcare providers themselves, who say, "Oh, the insurer is paying for this. We're gonna, double charge, or we're gonna," and so they have to really clamp down on controlling the costs from the healthcare provider side and really scrutinizing the claims. And this is huge volumes of very small claims, so their claims processing department, is a very labor-intensive process. So what they want to experiment with now is providing their own healthcare, so that they can better manage the cost of providing it, and at the basic level, and then referring serious stuff to specialists. But at least to address the more basic healthcare needs.
What about life insurance? Are you finding that in terms of especially voluntary life insurance, is what my question is about, that you need to educate consumers on the value, given that it's sort of far in the future, they're usually managing risk day to day, or is it present enough in their life that it's not a hard sell? How do you see that? And I'll share a joke. We did some market research, and I was in a focus group, and I'll say it in Spanish, and then I'll translate it. One woman said, "Muere la esposa, el marido se goza." And so it says, the wife dies, and the husband goes out to town, meaning, why would I buy life insurance so that my husband can have a party after I die? And I'm just, so it was in Mexico, actually, and I think it was an exception, but I'm wondering, do you have any problems in some, or do your grantee companies have problems in making the case for life insurance?
So to address that particular problem that that she mentioned, what I've seen a lot of organizations do is that the beneficiary is actually the child or a guardian of the child, because that's what the woman wants, is to make sure that the husband doesn't go off and get another wife, but that the child is taken care of.
Yeah.
In terms of making life insurance attractive, there's two main different types of life insurance. One would be term life insurance, where for a period of time, if you died during that term, you would get, your beneficiary would get the benefit. And the other one is life insurance that builds up value and has a savings component. And that's more interesting to us because it's difficult. Term insurance is pretty straightforward, and so it's not as innovative. This is the microinsurance innovation facility, so we're trying to find ways of promoting innovations. But having the savings component helps to reduce one of the major obstacles that the poor has with insurance, which is, if I pay my premium and the risk event doesn't occur, then can I get my money back? The whole risk pooling idea that money's actually being used to pay for the claims of other people just doesn't necessarily resonate very quickly. And the poor have limited amounts of resources, and so they want to use those resources as effectively or efficiently as possible. And so if they're paying money and not getting anything in return, they feel like they've wasted their money. So if you can combine life insurance with savings component, then they're building up value and having the risk protection at the same time. The problem with this type of product typically is that if the policyholder stops paying a premium or misses payments for whatever reason, and this is something that people with limited incomes have difficulty being able to make regular premium payments, then the policy can lapse, if they can't continue to pay at all, then they might have to surrender the policy. And if they don't take it all the way to the full 10 or 15 years or whatever the length of the policy term is, then they're going to have very little to show for it, or nothing to show for all the premium payments that they're made. And it's a way that insurance companies can make tons of money, in fact, by getting people to start these policies. And if they stop paying the premiums, then the insurance company benefits from that process. So what one of the organizations we're working with in India has what they call a non-lapsable product. which is trying to overcome this. So it requires a large upfront premium of 1,000 rupees, and then the policy stays in force for the period. I think it's a 5-year term, and then any additional money that people want to put onto it, they're welcome to, but they don't have to. And so that way, you know, it helps to accommodate the irregular incomes or cash flows of low-income people. The other thing that's interesting about this is that people can make those deposits or top up their accounts at their local mom and pop shop. So they're experimenting with handheld technologies, handheld terminals, and cards that allow people to put money on top of their account in a convenient way, so they don't have to go, you know, 10 miles to the local insurance agent's office.
That's really interesting. So you're seeing both different distribution channels, meaning not just microfinance institutions, but sort of mom-and-pop retailers, as well as new products, which I think is something I think Frontier Investments is really focused on, meaning how do we push the frontier and look at expanding financial inclusion. Would you say that's the exception? You think that's going to be the rule in the future in terms of the delivery channel and this use of technology to expand inclusion?
I think it's definitely going to become much more common. I think the whole notion of being able to have banking services in a variety of different locations that's more convenient for people, and being able to use technology to make that possible is definitely a big trend that I see will continue.
Mm-hmm. Maybe to close up, what do you think the greatest challenge to the industry? I mean, it sounds really exciting what's happening. Where do you think the greatest challenge lies to expanding microinsurance and access to the poor?
Well, I think maybe at 3 different levels. So one would be this issue at the policyholder or prospective policyholder level, overcoming the reticence that they may have, the reluctance to take insurance seriously or believe it's for them. I think getting more products that are better designed for low-income people in the market so that they can see them in action, see that the insurers are fulfilling their obligations, will create a demonstration effect and hopefully move toward creating more of a culture of insurance where people turn to insurance as a logical component in their risk management strategy. You know, it's not going to solve all of the problems, but it should be one of the tools that they have access to. So that's at the policyholder level. At the insurer level, I think that, you know, there's some converts of insurance companies that are taking this seriously and really making a major effort to innovate and find ways of getting to the bottom of the pyramid. But I'm quite keen on finding ways of promoting their successes to get others to buy into this as well. So I think there's still a natural resistance from insurers to think of the poor as a legitimate market or a market opportunity that they should take seriously. And then the third level would be at the regulatory or the enabling environment level. And it could be regulatory, it could be sort of MESO level infrastructure that's needed. Data is a big problem, for example. You know, in order to price products appropriately, there needs to be useful data, and there isn't for this market segment. In some countries, there isn't any data that's very effective at all. So instead, the actuary, whoever's pricing the product, puts on a big risk, on top of that, so that in case they're not quite sure what the price really should be, at least they've got a big buffer built into the price. So that makes the products less affordable to the poor. So the more data we have about the real risks and the real costs associated with the risk, the better it's going to be to make products more affordable. And then some of the innovations that we're talking about in terms of alternative delivery channels, you know, who can sell insurance, certain things around product design are not the way the insurance industry has been built up over time. This is, you know, changing the game. And insurance regulators need to be in a position to recognize that and think through what the implications are. And we have the good fortune to be working very closely with the International Association of Insurance Supervisors, the IAIS, which is based in Basel, and it's the global association for insurance supervision. And they've really embraced this idea of microinsurance and are looking at ways of promoting more appropriate insurance regulations to make it possible to provide insurance to low-income people.
Do you think that's going to be the next big breakthrough, these sort of getting insurance companies to use the alternative channels, or where do you see the next, or will it be on a product side, where do you see the next breakthrough coming in microinsurance?
Well, I think this technology bit is, one of the challenges with microinsurance is having huge volumes of very small premiums and managing that cost effectively. And so the more that we can find ways of utilizing technology to overcome that challenge, I think that will help make, if in your premium 30 or 40% of what you're paying just goes for the administrative costs, then you're not getting very good value for your money. And so if we can get that 30 or 40% down to, 5 or 10% through group policies using technology to be more efficient, that's going to hopefully provide better value to the poor.
Fantastic. Well, Craig, thank you for your time today, and thanks all our listeners for spending these moments with us.
To learn more about the Center for Financial Inclusion, please visit our website at www.centerforfinancialinclusion.org.